Welcome back, everyone, to the Prepared Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Austin, and this week, there's so much going on, right, with the attack over the weekend on Iran and the repercussions that are coming from that, both here domestically, politically. You know, we're seeing, at least here in Michigan, right, and some of you guys have been listening to this for a while, know I'm in the Metro Detroit area, and the city of Dearborn that has a very, I'll say, strong Muslim population, right? There's already videos being posted and have been for the last several days of people coming out, protesting in the streets and screaming death to America, death to Americans. And this is being regarded as, you know, peaceful protest. I actually had somebody drop into my DMs, right? And when I shared the story on social medias, and which part of this isn't peaceful? And I mean, I had to laugh at that. You know what I mean? The part where you're calling for the death of innocent people based off of a religious difference, which, you know, hey, that used to be what everybody screamed at the Catholics about, right? Oh, Christians and Catholics and the Crusades and blah, blah. We all hate the Catholic Church. And then now this is what's going on. This, what, to be fair, right? This tension was already rising right before we got to this point. Now it's just, I it's even worse. So I think a lot of people are on edge. There's so much we could get into this week. But I have a different conversation topic for us. This was actually something that, as we push into 2026, I'm trying to be more conscious of when you guys reach out and have requests on things to talk about here on the podcast. Certainly, we could talk politics, we could talk current events. That's something I try my best to keep to the Sunday sit rep discussions. So if you guys want to hear my first round thoughts on that, I did drop a Sunday sit rep on Sunday, right? So the episode previous to this. But I am trying to take the feedback and the requests that you guys have seriously and incorporate that into our planning of what the episodes and discussion topics can look like, as well as the guests too. Because at this point, it's not always about bringing on a new guest. Sometimes it's about bringing on somebody who's an expert in a certain field, who's been a repeat guest, right? That can, you know, somebody like Blake Flannery or Joe Fasanella or, you know, any of these people that specialize in certain either skill sets or are subject experts in certain things that you guys want to hear about. And so, you know, today's subject or discussion, right, actually comes out of comments in our YouTube channel. And if you guys are listening to this and you don't know that we have a YouTube channel, you can go find us on that platform, right? It's the Prepared Mindset. Same logo, right? The mountain range, the rising sun, you know, and the North Star and all that. It's the same logo, same channel. It's me talking about all kinds of different stuff. And we're pushing towards 5,000 subscribers. So at the time of this recording anyways, I think we're about 80 off of it, which is really, really cool and very, very exciting as we get close to that benchmark. But had a request to do another rifle discussion of sorts. And I think right now it's really pertinent as people are becoming, you know, just once again, this isn't supposed to be incendiary. You know, I'm not telling people to get violent by any means. But if people have questions about building out rifles with everything that's going on, I think, you know, hey, maybe it is a good time to talk about this. Maybe it is a good time with a gap in the schedule, right, to talk about carbines and rifles and setups and at least my opinion and perspective, right, as somebody who is a prepared civilian who shoots, trains, has a lot of insight, never done it professionally, though. And you're probably going to get a lot of different answers on this from a lot of different people. This is just, you know, me throwing my hat in the ring, sharing my particular flavor of how I see certain things. I mean, and I'm going to do my best to make it, you know, a logical progression on what we start with, what we build to, good ideas, bad ideas. But before I get to that, you guys, we are a sponsored podcast. The Prepared Mindset is a sponsored podcast, and I want to make sure I take a moment here and say thank you to my friends over at Custom Night Vision, you guys. You can check out their website yourself. It's customnightvision.com. And in these uncertain times, I'll tell you what, having a capability ad like night vision actually gives me a little, not a ton, but a little more peace of mind, right? Because it is dark out. Actually, right now, still, I think, more than half the time. So being able to see in the dark is a huge capability add for you. And if it's something you've been looking into for a while, I encourage you, reach out to the team over at Custom Night Vision. You can go over to the website. They have a chat function that's actually built into the lower right-hand corner of the site. Again, that's customnightvision.com. Or at the bottom of the page there, they have the shop phone number listed. You can reach out to Kevin or Ben or Trevor. Let them know that Austin from Prepared Mindset set you guys over. They're going to take fantastic care of you, whether your questions are around, hey, I only have enough to afford, you know, single tubes, but I really want dual tubes. You know, what are my options look like if I get cheaper, quote unquote, cheaper tubes, right, from something like some company like NNVT where it's green or white phosphor? Hey, am I going to see a big difference? What's that like? Can you give me some insight there? Their goal as a company is to give you guys the most transparent purchasing experience possible. So yes, single tube versus dual tube, green phosphor versus white phosphor, right? Gen 2 versus Gen 3, and all the questions that people have when they're trying to make their first purchase with night vision. And additionally, if you guys are looking for the accessories, right? Maybe you bought a tube, you got a used one on a good deal or something. Head over to the website. They carry the full line of Team Wendy helmets, and they include the discount code in the item description. They also include lights and lasers from companies like Modlight and B.E. Myers and Steiner and Wilcox and a whole bunch more. You guys, Custom Night Vision truly is your one-stop shop for all things night vision. So you can walk in, or I guess log in if you're going online, right, and go from zero to complete with your setup. Or if you're just looking for an upgrade, a housing swap, or to add a piece of kit like a helmet from Team Wendy, they're your guys again. It's customnightvision.com. Let them know that Austin from Prepared Mindset sent you. It's going to be awesome. You guys are going to love it. So big shout out to those guys. Like I said, right now, especially being able to see in the dark, as we're still not fully into the spring season yet. We're still kind of in that wintry side of things, even though we are, yes, in March. The nights are still longer, and being able to see, right, especially if you have the capability of a laser and things like that, where you have those concerns, or an IR illuminator, where it can allow you to make identification in the dark, right, with, you know, well, you guys make those decisions on your own. I'm not telling you what to do with a firearm. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, and this is not legal advice, so do what you got to do, but it is nice when you can see in the dark and other people can't. So IR illumination is a big, big capability yet. You know, and certainly as we get into the discussion today, talking about you setting up a fighting rifle and some of the thoughts that, like, we get to the end of it, those items like lasers, like IR illumination, like flashlights, maybe not flashlights, but definitely IR units for sure, is kind of towards the end of things, because it's one of those items that you don't always need if you don't have night vision. But if you want to run NODs, you definitely need to get into some of that stuff. It's really important. Those are tools that... I don't know that yet in the, you know, the domestic United States, I would say the continental United States, right, that everybody has access to night vision, but it is really cool that the point of entry is getting lower and lower with, you know, the prices on Gen 2 devices, the innovation on some cheaper, yes, albeit overseas housings that are available that you see out there floating in the market, and then obviously cheaper lasers too. So we'll get into that. We'll talk about all of it. But like I said, this was something that you guys, the listeners, the listening, participating audience, right, asked for. And if you guys are looking for more access to information like this, for you guys can reach out and say, hey, talk about this, talk about that. We do have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/prepared_mindset_pod. So if what we have on the Instagram and the YouTube combined and paired with what we do here on the podcast is not enough, or you're not finding specifically what you're looking for, the Patreon, you can contact us directly. You can make specific requests, and we can do shorter one-off pieces of content. That's part of what you get with the Patreon package. So if you want to look for another way to help support us, in addition to like our Spreadshirt shop and stuff like that, that's linked through our Instagram, in our bio there, then you can check out the Patreon as well. But enough of that stuff. You know, I know the ad read section is quite painful for some of you guys. So we're going to go ahead and we're just going to jump into the discussion around building a fighting rifle. And I think that it's a good one, you know, because what we see still, and it's an outdated concept, is for a homestead, you know, if we're talking about ye olden times, but even in today's cases in society where we live in very suburban environments for most of us, not all of us, but for most of us, the older adage or older idea of leaving a 12 gauge shotgun in the closet that your wife will go grab, or just a handgun that you are large enough and strong enough to shoot well, and just, oh, well, hey, I'm going out of town, honey. Here's my 40, you know, cal Glock sitting next to the bed. And she's never shot it. She doesn't know how to work it. She doesn't know how to manage the recoil and stuff, which is very doable, right? We had Amy Abbott on here a couple years ago now, and she's up in Alaska. She runs 40 cal. You know what I mean? It's very, very doable. I think in a lot of instances, we are... we don't give women enough due credit. I guess I'll say that. We don't give women enough due credit with what they can do Some men, I think, make assumptions based on what they hope their wife is able to do in a self-defense situation, right? Hey, here's my 45. Hey, here's my 40. Hey, here's this little, you know, super compact 9mm that I can't shoot well, but I'm gonna leave it here for you anyways. And the same thing with the shotgun, you know, like the shotgun is referred to by a lot of people in many circles as the thinking man's weapon. And it can be devastating. You know what I mean? The shotgun really is a great tool if you know how to run it and you've trained on how to run it. And here's the thing, birdshot is not realistic. I mean, it's going to hurt someone. I'm not saying it's not going to, but birdshot, buckshot, maybe not going to be the most effective home defense ammunition. And additionally, that's your responsibility as well, right? As a prepared citizen and a lawful gun owner is understanding ballistically what firearm is going to be best for you for home defense, right? If you live in tract housing where it's all siding homes, bungalows and whatnot, where the walls, there's not anything that even could be remotely considered a ballistic barrier between you and your neighbor's home, you need to be aware of that. So maybe a smaller caliber or maybe a 12 gauge with buckshot is going to be better for you in those cases. Maybe a slug isn't. Maybe a 45 or, you know, 300 blackout 5.56 is not necessarily the best choice. Maybe it's okay, right? You know, I know in a lot of neighborhoods, my neighborhood included, we have brick homes that sometimes have some siding on the front or a part of the side just to, like, as a facade, it kind of dresses it up, right? But they're brick homes, meaning that if, you know, I'm shooting through walls, which you shouldn't be, right? You should be shooting at your target and we should practice judicious marksmanship, right? If it goes through a wall, it's going through a layer of, you know, older homes are going to be wet plaster, newer ones are going to be drywall, right? And then you're going through one layer of brick, exiting that and going into a second layer of brick, exiting that and then going through another layer of drywall and or wet plaster before it would be potentially hitting somebody. Now, I'm not saying, hey, oh, don't worry about it if you live in brick homes. What I'm saying is you are at a slight advantage if that's the case. The best solution with any firearm is always going to be strong marksmanship and accountable shot placement, right? And that's why, I, when we talk about a fighting rifle, especially for defending your home, but also just for, you know, actually fighting, that's why it's advantageous, because the 5.56 round, which is the most common rifle round in America, I know we have a lot of high-performing options that are available to us. That's one of the great freedoms we're afforded because of the Second Amendment. You have options out there. Yes, 300 blackout, right? Not a bad choice, right? Especially if you're talking about home defense. But if you look at like 6 ARC and 6.5 Creedmoor and 308 and 7.62 and, you know, 5x45 and whatever, just depending on a lot of different things, right? We have a lot to choose from that from a ballistic performance standpoint are going to be very, very good choices for you. But you have to then, from that, I'll say that sort of that refined menu of calibers that we just kind of rattled through. And there's more. Like, I'm sure there's going to be somebody, you know, who just heard that list of like 5 or 7, whatever calibers I rattled off and was like, well, actually, which one you didn't? It's like, dude, I'm not going to run, you know, some weird old gun that shoots 17 Hornet because you told me that's what you kill deers with. I don't know. But I digress. We have those options. We have that access. It is your responsibility to study and understand and research the ballistic performance of those rounds and make a decision based on where you live and your home as to what's going to work best for you. If you have overpenetration concerns, then you need to take a step down. There's no right, wrong, this, that, or the other about it. You need to go with a weaker round. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. You know, but here's the reality of it. If you're not training on a regular basis, and I do mean, you know, every other week or every 3 weeks at the range or something where you don't miss, you know, that's not the case for so many people. Like, we hear that and go, yeah, I go to the range once a month. That's not a big deal. Or, oh, we're talking CQB distances. We're talking 15 yards. How do you miss? And we would all probably be surprised by a number of civilian involved shootings where obviously that's not the case. But getting into setting up a rifle, right? We have a lot of platforms, and it seems like as the years go by, right, we have more and more platforms we can choose from. Now, I'm going to recommend, based off of my experiences, that the rounds you look at would be the two most available ones because they also lend themselves, or three most available, right, because they lend themselves to not only home defense, But in the event that we do have armed conflict in this country, which, depending on what happens politically in certain cities around the country, that could be a reality sooner than many of us would like. And I pray to God that it's not. But that, to me, that's the 556 or, you know, 223/556, because they're kind of cross-compatible. Just make sure your barrel is either a 223 wild, which can shoot both of them, or it's a 556 barrel, which can shoot both of them. 300 blackout, which can't use the same barrel, but can use the same lower end magazines. Ballistically is going to perform great for home defense, and shorter distances out to long distance, you start to see a much higher drop off. It does not have the range that a 556 round does, and it's not supposed to. It's designed for something very different, right? And then we get into 308, which up close is going to be absolutely devastating. It's going to perform great out at distance, right? And it's designed for, you know, DMR and SPR applications, right? That's the 308 round. 6.5 Creedmoor, a little bit softer shooting, a little bit faster round. Definitely less accessible in my experiences. I had a 6.5 Creedmoor bolt gun that I bought right around the time that COVID happened. If you guys go way, 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 way back, right? Back into the archives of this podcast when I talked about, you know, I was going to go out and I was going to start hunting. I was going to start trying to harvest meat, right, for my family, venison and whatnot, which never really happened, never really got off the ground for a couple of reasons. But I could not find 6.5 Creedmoor ammo. I had a lot of issues finding boxes that when I found it on the shelves in the store, I think I found in a year and a half's time, and I didn't look super hard and I didn't order online because at that time ammo prices skyrocketed. I could not find reasonably priced 6.5 Creedmoor ammo at my local Cabela's or my local gun shops. So I found a ton of 308. I regretted that I got 6.5 Creedmoor. I liked shooting it more than 308. But it was not as available as I would have liked. I ended up actually trading that rifle in towards a Glock 45, which I shoot a ton now, and you guys see in a lot of the content that I do online. So better decision for me overall. But getting back to a rifle, 5.56 is the most commonly used round by domestic law enforcement and obviously our military. And I know there's a bunch of stuff going on right now with the military switching rounds, potentially switching to the SIG Spear platform, which has a ton of other issues and everything. But if you're talking about ammo capability and the depth of understanding around ballistic performance and material penetration, 5.56 is going to have the most resources available from an information standpoint, from an instructorial standpoint, and beyond, right? So that's the reason right now, as of the time of this recording, you know, March 3rd of 2026, I recommend the 5.56 round. If you like something else, cool. I think a lot of what I talk about after this is still going to be applicable, but if you're asking me, that's why I go with this. Magazines are plentiful, ammo is plentiful, they're both affordable, and I also recommend the AR platform. You know, AR standing for Armalite Rifle. For any of you guys that are new that are joining us, that let's just like address that, because it is a common thing to hear from mainstream media. AR literally stands for assault rifle. I love when I get liberal friends or liberal people online or liberal people in discussions who go, "Why do you need that?" It literally stands for, and I love that they misuse the term literally, but they also are speaking from a point of ignorance, right? Because it stands for Armalite Rifle. Armalite, of course, being the company who pioneered and created that design. It is the Armalite Rifle 15. The AR-10 is the same rifle, but it's chambered in 308. So AR-15 being very, very common. And I like, you know, I like the platform because, again, the parts, the pieces, the components, when things break, when you just swap stuff out or upgrade, they're plentiful. They're available. And in most cases, they're very affordable. Are there other platforms that are out there, like the BRN 180, like the SCAR 16, that are chambered in 5.56 that are good platforms that you can run? Yes. You want to go get a Bren or something? Yeah, you can do that. If you want a larger caliber, you want to go out and get like a surplus FAL? Okay, cool. You can go do that. I have shot the FAL. I actually do like the FAL. I know some militaries around the world still use those. Again, the ammo availability and price, because we got to talk about training, right, is a big deal. Also, they're pretty unwieldy. Even like the para versions of those with folding metal stocks and shorter barrels, which are, it's hard to find parts for those. We couldn't get my buddies to gas correctly. And of the three magazines that he had, only one of them fed correctly. So just understand, guys, if you're not a huge AR fan, and maybe you're into like some goofy platform like the FAL or some very rare version of the AK platform that doesn't have a lot of interchangeability or something, just understand that if you have those issues, right, where you have unreliable magazines that don't like to feed, they don't like to seat, they're inconsistent even after you like clean the shit out of them and you try primo ammo and it's still a problem, whether it's the magazine or the ammo or the platform itself, and like you don't know how to work on it, right? In the event that we see armed conflict in this country, you're going to be shit out of luck. And I'm not trying to be a dick by saying that. I'm just giving you the reality of it. That if you don't know how to work on it yourself and you don't have the dedicated time to sit there with a manual and guess and check and take it out to your property, you know, out back and go shoot to test the change that you made and stuff, you may be setting yourself up for failure. You may be putting yourself and your family in a worse position. And so, again, I'm going to go back and say that's why I recommend people look at the AR platform. It's available. It's affordable. You can shoot it. And the recoil is actually, you know, and we'll get into suppressors in a moment, but even without a suppressor, with a 14.5 or a 16-inch barrel and a mid-length gas system, it's going to be pretty enjoyable to shoot. You can tune those things pretty easily, relatively affordably, right, with buffer weights and springs and adjustable gas blocks and bolt carriers, whatever. You can soften those up a good bit, and it's going to be an easier platform to shoot, both for you, for your wife, for potentially if you have older children, right? AR pistols, right, with a brace on it, you know, or if you got an SBR, whatever, it's going to be easier to shoot. Now, when we talk about the AR platform and we talk about ballistic performance of the 5.56 round, the first thing everybody gets into, oh, I shoot an AR, and then they usually rattle off whatever, barrel length. And this is a discussion point that I think a lot of people have a lot of different opinion on based on their own experiences. And I'm just going to give you mine. I'm not going to say that, you know, your buddy who deployed during the GWAT is wrong. I'm not going to say that because they probably stacked some bodies if they have an opinion on it. And I have not. But I'll try to give you guys some context around these choices and around the performance of some of this stuff that's going to help hopefully close some of the gaps, fill in some of the gaps, right? Give you some additional information that's going to help you make the best choice for you. Understand that a lot of the time, right, when we get former service folks and former law enforcement folks that have an opinion of this is the best, this is what you need, this is why this is what I used and why I used it or whatever. In those instances, that was a, hey, this is what you're issued, so this is what you have to use. And then if you're able to be successful with it, good. That means your training held up and you figured out a way to be successful with that. It does not always mean that it's going to be the best use case for you as an armed civilian, right? Because if you look at the end goals and the end missions of the platform, right, it's very different. You know, I'm sure if you talk to the Marines that were building clearing in Fallujah with 18-inch ARs or M16s, right, they probably would have been like, yeah, dude, or 20-inch, right? I don't even know what the barrel length was, but you say, hey, are you good with that? Or would you have liked a 14.5, an 11.5, or, you know, like a 10.5-inch Mark 18? They probably would have been good with a shorter platform for a lot of that. Now, obviously, the trade-off being that when you go to a shorter barrel, yes, it's more compact, so it's better for close-up shooting, compact for moving around and within structures, yes, but the shorter the barrel, the worse the ballistic performance is out to, I think after like 400 or 500 yards, you really see the 5.56 round drop off. And if that's the case where you need and are expecting to have those engagements out the distance, then just pick a longer barrel. It's not that big a deal. The round will perform pretty reliably out to about 1,000 yards if you know what you're doing. You know, there's some limitation there. You know, you're not going to get one round that does absolutely everything. And if you plan to be shooting out to 1,000 yards, then you should probably be looking at a 308, not at a 5.56. But again, that's not what I'm doing, so that's not what I'm talking about and recommending. What I will point out, because there are still options out here on the market, is that Crane did a lot of testing and a lot of research when they were developing the Mark 18 program, the Mod Zero, right? So a pin front sight post. How short can we make these barrels? Crane did a lot of testing and research on it, and 10.3 inches is where was kind of that point of diminishing returns where it didn't make sense to keep shortening that barrel because the ballistic performance was getting worse and worse after that point. So we see a lot of 10.3s and a lot more 10.5s commercially available, right? Because that extra, I mean, that extra 0.2 inch, whatever, if you're trying to be clone correct, which is not in the scope of this discussion at all, but if you cloner guys are out there, you know, oh, well, it's 10.3, it's not 10.5. Yes, I get it, but like, just bear with me for the sake of this conversation and what we're trying to achieve here. I know that there's companies out there that make 8-inch and 9-inch ARs in 5.56, and I think Springfield sells one. And that's not to say they're not going to hurt somebody. It's not going to say they're not going to kill someone, right? Just understand that you're putting yourself at a greater disadvantage with those shorter platforms. Once you start breaking out past, 100 yards, can you still be capable with it? Can you still be confident? Yes, it'll still do a lot of stuff. Your holds are going to have to be adjusted for that. You're going to really have to understand ballistically how that's going to perform. And there's probably going to be a little bit less data available out there for you because of that. The common lengths that are, used today, and then especially the ones that were deployed with, so 10.5 and 14.5, I know specifically there's a lot of data out there because those were, when we talk about the Mark 18s and the Daniel uppers and stuff like that, 14.5, 10.5, those were issued to the military, and we have more data on those. Now we're seeing other stuff come out like 11.5s, that's what I run on the gun I shoot the most, 12.5, you're seeing 13.7s, 13.9s, you have some guys out there doing 12.7s, it depends on what you're trying to do. And do I think you're going to be at a major disadvantage getting a 12.7 versus a 14.5? Like, no, and vice versa, right? But just understand your capabilities and your limitations. Like I said, I shoot an 11.5 most of the time because that's just, I train CQB on a weekly basis, right? And I take classes on this stuff. I seek out sources of information. That's what, from a holdover standpoint with my optic, which we'll get into here in just a second, and the performance of the round at certain, out to 200 yards, it's predictable for me. I can zero at 50 and 200 and know where I'm going to hold and hit, because that's how I train, right? A lot of guys like 12.5. 12.5 is a great option as well. Just understand, as you get a little bit longer, right, some of the stuff internal of buildings, if that's a primary concern for you, gets a little bit harder, but it's still very, very doable, right? So pick the barrel length that's going to make the most sense for you. And what I will say about barrels is you don't necessarily have to get the most primo bull barrel. Bull meaning there's more material to it. It's a heavier barrel. You're going to get less flex out of it. It's going to be more accurate for you. You don't have to get a bull barrel to ensure accuracy. You can get government profile barrels that are just fine. What I will say is just buy from a reputable brand. I've had a lot of luck personally with Roscoe and FN when you can get them. Here's the thing with a barrel, if you're spending under $100, I would really question why it's under $100. If it's a sale, that's different. But there are really, really cheap barrels to be had out there for around 50, 60 bucks. And sometimes you get lucky, but a lot of the times it's because the QC is skipped out on some of those things. And when you go to assemble the rifle, if you're doing it yourself, right? You could be in for a real fucking headache and have to, ship some stuff back and forth to get it addressed, or take it to a gunsmith who's going to be able to fit it for you. And you're going to have to go pay a bunch of money. That's the reality of that. If you buy pre-built uppers off the shelf, yes, you will not have to worry about that stuff most of the time, right? Just understand that you may be a little bit limited in what you can buy off the shelf. I'm not always a huge proponent of buying a completely pre-built rifle off of a retail shelf, like a Cabela's or something. Now, if your local shop does builds and you know the gunsmith there to be a good guy that selects quality components, like we have a shop here locally that opened within the last 4 or 5 months, Average Joe's. And Joe and Evan, the two owners, are buddies of mine, and I know they have done a lot of builds, like a lot. Using parts and components from companies like Colt and BCM and stuff. And they understand where you can cut some corners and where you can't. And if you have those kinds of people at your local shop, then you can go to them and go, hey, I need to build a fighting rifle. Where can I skimp out? Like, their guidance will go far for you. And it doesn't have to be a complete BCM upper build. It doesn't have to be a complete, fill in the blank company build. But there are certain parts and components you want to make sure you spend the money on. I would say certainly your barrel is probably one of those, and then also your bolt carrier group, because having an out-of-spec bolt carrier can cause a lot of issues, tons of issues, right? If your head spacing is off with how it locks in and everything in your chamber and all that stuff, tons of issues that you can, at that point, you're just guessing, like, oh, is it the bolt itself? Is the machining off somewhere? Do I need to adjust gassing? Is it, whatever, right? And it could take you quite a while to figure some of that stuff out. So I run a suppressor, so I have an adjustable bolt carrier group that helps vent off some of the gassing, and that's from Bootleg Industries. And I'm not paid, not sponsored on any of this stuff. I don't have any rifle companies that are sponsoring me for any of this stuff. Now, that said, would I like to? Sure. Like, who doesn't want another rifle? But I will, I'm just going to share with you guys the benefits of my experiences. You know, the gas port on my Roscoe Bloodlines that I've had is a little bit larger. It's a proprietary size. So the guns are a little gassy, and that's why I have the adjustable bolt carrier group. It's worked really well for me. I didn't want to get an adjustable gas block because I don't want to have to like fuck with sticking tools through the handguard to adjust it and do this, that, and the other thing. I adjusted my buffer spring and buffer weight, and then also the bolt carrier group, and that has been good for me. Now, if you're not shooting suppressed, just, guys, don't make this overcomplicated. Go with a regular 5-position buffer tube and a regular, I think it's A5, a regular carbine buffer spring and buffer weight. That stuff, like, it with a mil-spec setup on your upper receiver, basically with either a carbine length gas system or a mid-length gas system, and you'll have to make sure, right, when you get your barrel and then your gas tube, that those line up. Gas block is pretty universal. And then just make sure that everything goes together well and get a quality upper receiver, right? BCM makes great upper receivers. You actually have to heat fit the barrels into the upper, which for most folks is a pain in the ass. For a gunsmith that knows what they're doing and has dealt with them before, it's not that big of a deal. It just takes a little bit longer, but it's going to be a much more reliable fitment than just sliding on in there and tightening down a barrel nut. Not to say that that's bad, but a tight fit, less tolerance play is going to be better for you, especially with your barrel lock up to your upper receiver. I think when Trevor built his BCM, and we just did a video on this, you guys can go check this if you have questions. We just did a video on the YouTube channel of him walking through it. I know when I bought my BCM, just the upper, not anything else, no barrel, anything like that. The complete upper kit, so it came with a dust cover and the spring and the forward assist and everything. I paid $90 for it as a blem. I think when Trevor found his, it was like $50 on sale because it was the holidays. So you can find some really sick deals on stuff from Bravo Company Manufacturing, BCM. And they're a well-respected brand with a history of just putting out good products and great customer service. And the other thing I will mention, because we are talking about the upper receiver here, two things. One, a forward assist, in my opinion, is required equipment. I've actually had rounds not want to seat into the gun. And then when you hit that forward assist a couple times and the bolt is not going all the way home, it's one of the easiest ways to tell that you have a problem in the chamber. Now, for me, when it happened, it was a crumpled primer from a spent round that just came apart from the casing and got lodged. Not a big deal, but I had to completely disassemble the gun and use like a little paint can lid tool, or something to like pop out that crumpled primer. Stuff happens. It happens. That was an ammo issue. It was not the gun. And I didn't use that ammo brand again after that. But that kind of stuff happens. And then also, I would make sure that you spend money on a good, reliable charging handle. When I say good and reliable, here's what I mean. Either get a mil-spec from a reputable brand, which even from like good brands, mil-spec charging handles are very simple. They're very plain, and they're usually somewhere between $15 and $20. So worst comes to worst, you can get one of those and it's not going to fail you. The design is very, very simple. If you want to get a better charging handle, quote unquote better here, right, you can get some that help with gas mitigation if you're shooting suppressed so it doesn't come back into your nose and stuff if you like to lay your face across your stock. If you want something with ambidextrous controls so it has articulating levers on both sides of the receiver so you can run that charging handle with your right hand, your left hand, however you have it oriented, it's going to work with that. Some really good ones in that regard that I've had luck with are the Radian Raptor and then the Geissele Airborne. Both really, really good charging handles. And there's, I know Breek, I think it's a sledgehammer, I've had guys tell me is really good. And then if you don't want ambi, you don't have to have an ambi charging handle. If you want a little bit nicer charging handle, Voltor used to make them for BCM, and you can still get those Voltor ones. That's what I have on my SPR that I set up, and I like it. I don't need ambi controls on that gun, so I'm good with it. Just get something reliable. Do not go buy, and I've done this before, I've also seen a lot of pictures and posts online of people doing this, and it almost never ends well. Do not go buy the knockoff version of whatever charging handle you want, and definitely don't take one off of like one of those gas blowback airsoft guns and just drop it into your AR-15. They are not going to last. Those pins are going to shear, like knockoffs of the Radiant Raptor, because okay, those charging handles are $80 to $100. They're more if you want the one with the gas venting and the gas mitigation, because it's extra features, it's American made, it's high quality. Yes, there's a brand tax with it to a degree, but yes, I wanted one. I spent $90, I think, on the Raptor that I got. Anyways, I digress. When that charging handle fails, if those tabs break off at all, right, especially if you only have like, if you don't have an ambi handle, and that tab snaps off and you can't unlock or easily unlock and articulate that charging handle to cycle that bolt, you can no longer run that gun if you need to. So you got a clear malfunction or something, you're fucked. If you need to lock that bolt back to clear a malfunction, like a bolt override or something, you're fucked. And you can't mortar either, because that requires you using the charging handle. So it's one of the simplest things to do right on a build, but it's also one of the things you see people make like the stupidest decisions on, because, oh, it's a charging handle. Oh, it's gotta be ambi, gotta have the cool guy stuff. And it's like, well, if you want a good one, then it's going to cost you some, you know, between $70 and $150 for whatever reason, depending on what you're getting. But it's also, it's the most essential control on the weapon next to the safety and the trigger, right? So just make sure whatever you're doing with that, it makes sense, and understand that bigger latches are not always better. That actually usually just means that it's easier to catch on your kit. And there's some locking charging handles. The deadlock from Sentry is a really cool design where you actually have to push a button on the back of the charging handle to be able to unlock and then articulate that charging handle. So if you have that issue, you know, it's going to keep that locked in for you. My thoughts especially are like, you know, law enforcement who don't always have to pull the rifle out and they're not used to manipulating it. It's probably a great tool for them. But altogether, just make sure you're selecting good parts. Get a good bolt carrier. You don't have to get the greatest and most, you know, primo barrel. Gas block and gas tube, as long as you're not getting an adjustable one, don't have to be anything wild and crazy. I think BCM actually sells both of those and they're pretty affordable. Like I said, charging handle is a big deal. And then if you're not shooting suppressed, just get a carbine length buffer and buffer spring, you know, and you'll be okay for the most part with that. Now, when we talk about some of the other stuff that comes with it, like we look at handguards and how you're going to put stuff on the upper, like we'll stick with the upper part of the gun here, right? Handguards to me, right now you basically have two options. You have Picatinny quad rails, right, which are very old school, very heavy, but because of that thickness of the material that you have to have for Picatinny, right, they're really durable. Like, you can bang those things against trees and they're going to be okay, right? Which is one of the reasons why most people, myself included, advocate for quad rails. Now, do we have better technology now that we can get M-lock handguards that are comparably strong? Yes, they're also going to be a little bit lighter. So I do say to most people, hey, unless you want a quad rail for some reason, and you can, like I still have a couple quad rails hanging around here, M-lock is probably the way to go. I know the BCM M-lock rail is really cool. I have the Geisley Mark 16 rail, which is a little bit more expensive. Understand that handguards, you get what you pay for. And what are we concerned with, right? Well, A, the good ones always come with their own barrel nut because they lock up and they want to make sure that that barrel nut is what secures the barrel to the upper receiver and what secures the handguards to the upper receiver. So it's kind of a super critical piece. And some of them are cut very specific ways, right? So you can't just take any old barrel nut and put any old handguard on there, right? That usually they're a pair. Cheaper ones that are just a friction fit, those may not, and the friction fit without any kind of locking tabs, I would have some concerns with. Here's why. If you have accessories that are aiming solutions, like, you know, backup iron sights, fixed iron sights, or IR lasers on your handguard, and that thing twists, you now do not have a reliable zero. You just don't. I also, when I was teaching the class back in December, you know, the class I did with Two Vets Development Group as an assistant instructor for their CQB Fundamentals course, we had a cop in that class who had his red dot mounted out onto his handguard. As a rule, guys, we do not mount optics, right? We do not mount optics out onto the handguard. And for whatever reason, it always seems like a good idea for guys to do this too, and it's not. You do not want your optic mount to be the bridge that holds your handguard to your upper receiver. So if it's got two set screws, don't put one on the handguard and one on the upper receiver and tighten down. Your optic gets mounted to your upper receiver, because then if the handguard itself does twist, your optic zero will stay true. Okay, so ideally it won't move at all, which is why getting a reliable handguard of some variety is going to be what you want. But also, you don't want a cheap one. The cheap knockoff ones are not always going to be in spec. So those little horizontal slots, the M-lock slots, right, that you have on, is it the KMR? Is that the one that the BCM makes? Or the Geisy M16, or Mark 16, I'm sorry, right? Whatever, they have those slots, as well as Midwest Industries, American Defense Manufacturing, the list goes on of good quality companies that make handguards out there. When you go to attach different items to that handguard, so whether that's a flashlight, that's a vertical grip, or a hand stop, or whatever have you, if those slots are not in spec, your accessories are not secure. So you could be running through the field or the woods or whatever, one good bump to your light, and then the mount that your light is attached to, right, comes off. And that's a huge problem, right? Because those are, A, really, really expensive, but now you can't see in the dark if you don't have night vision. Same thing like with your Picatinny slots on top of the receiver and down the top of your handguard. Those need to be in spec. And I've used knockoff rails before where I've had to actually file material or file powder coating off of it to get stuff to fit correctly. That's not how it's supposed to fucking work. Buy good handguards, you guys. And that brings me to another recommendation too with the handguard, is there's some really light ones out there where you get like one or two slots of Picatinny and then it slopes down and it's a completely smooth handguard till you get to the very end, and there's another two or three slots where you can like mount a fixed front sight post if you wanted to, or fixed front sight rather. I don't typically advocate for those, just because that real estate across the top there is where you're going to attach pressure pads. If you're doing multiple pressure pads, because you got lights and lasers and illuminators and whatever, if you have backup iron sights that you need to run behind a laser unit or something, or if you just have a laser in general, those one or two or three pick slots up front are not going to be enough to get most lasers mounted on there. It might, but I wouldn't, you know, then you are restricted to having to run it there. And if you have some kind of overhang or something past the handguard, that becomes a problem. So it just limits it. And, you know, and that's the point where we get into some weight savings and stuff. If you're running it for competitions, you know, and none of this shit matters, then like have a fucking blast, guys. But for a fighting rifle, just have the Picatinny across the top of your handguard. It's going to help with rigidity and strength, but it's also just going to help with what you want to put on there. If you're building some kind of DMR or GPR or SPR, whatever, you know, rifle, and you want to put some kind of level on there, having that out there, you know, might not hurt. Or if you have some kind of offset red dot that's out there that is a backup sighting system, yes, it should be mounted to the upper receiver, not the handguard, but if you run out of real estate, because that often happens if you're running, you know, LPVOs and stuff, you want to have the options. Okay, so just get a good handguard from a good reputable company, and then make sure, this is critical, and I don't know why this always has to be said, just follow torque specs, you guys. It's always hilarious to me when guys get out to the range and they, you know, with muzzle devices, handguards, whatever, stuff twists. You're like, oh, that's not supposed to happen. You're like, well, what the fuck happened? Like, oh, it twisted. Like, why the fuck did it twist? And it's because they didn't torque shit down. So with your muzzle device, whether it's a flash hider, muzzle brake, something to mount a suppressor, right, whatever, use a torque wrench. And if you don't have one, make friends with somebody who does have the right tools to torque that shit down. Because if you, and I'll tell you this, if you guys have muzzle devices that come loose and you're running a suppressor, that's the fastest way to get a baffle strike. And then your suppressor is basically just to look cool, because it won't do a whole lot of suppression at that point. So something to consider. Now, when we are talking about optics, again, this kind of goes back to the discussion we had moments ago on barrel length. Like, what are you trying to do with your fighting rifle? If you're trying to reach out to distances because you live out in the country and you think that you're going to have realistic shots between 50 yards to 500 yards, you know, at that point, make sure you understand what your ammo performance is. But optics wise, you're going to use probably right, an LPVO or an MPVO. So low power variable optic or medium power variable optic. So, low power basically always starts at one. So what you talk about, a 1-4 magnification, you can go from 1x to 2x to 3x to 4x. You can just use a little lever and twist the scope, right? 1 to 6 is very, very common, and so is 1 to 8 these days, and you can just twist. Sometimes you can end up in between numbers and stuff. You just get it where the sight picture is focused to what you need, and then you have to understand if you have first or second focal plane, you have to understand the reticle data that you can get from that reticle, so you understand your holds, which goes back to the ammo performance, which is something not well explained over the vocal medium only, so I'm not going to get super into it here on this podcast discussion. What I will just say is, if you have to go with a little bit cheaper optic, because this is what everybody does not understand with scopes, excuse me, is that glass is expensive. You can spend 3 times what you spend on the rifle on the glass alone, but get a good mount. So if you're going to get cheaper glass, get a good quality mount. Spend at least $150 on your scope mount, if not closer to $200, $300, sometimes even $400, getting a reliable scope mount, because that is your only optic. That tube has to stay put. When you zero it, you want it to hold zero. And with cheaper mounts, right, you know, I've seen stuff shift. I've seen stuff move. I've seen guys run $25 scope mounts, and it's like there is one like thumb tight screw. And you can put a screwdriver on it, yes. There's one screw that is holding that all together. And if that thing comes loose, your zero is completely fucked. So I usually, like, if you want to get stuff with QDs, that's cool. American Defense Manufacturing is a fantastic company that actually does a lot of, like, OEM white label production for other brands. Their QD levers and switches are the only ones I trust, for the most part. But especially on scope mounts. And their scope mounts are really, really good. We have a video on the YouTube channel going over building a GPR. It's a 2-part video where we built it and then shot it. And using the stuff from ADM. Really, really robust. Very, very reliable. If you are using separate like scope rings versus a one-piece mount, you can sometimes you can save some money that way. Just know that you're not going to be able to take that on and off very easily if you're switching between rifles. There's a reason we switched some of the cantilever mounts, because it's a little bit more just strength and rigidity to it. But it can work if that's all you have access to. And then just don't get the cheapest scopes you can find, guys. Like, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. I know there's some diamonds in the rough out there, companies like Vector, and I really like Swamp Fox. I run an MPVO from them. Just understand you might not have the greatest performance. And also, cheaper means you're losing something somewhere. I will say this about the Swamp Fox 2-10. It's a Warhawk. I really like it. I love the reticle. The glass is actually pretty damn good for the $600 it costs. It's a 34 millimeter tube to get more light transmission through, and it is a hog. It is fucking heavy, and it is much, like, if you compare it to the Leopold 2-10 in just like overall physical footprint, it's a much bigger looking optic. It's much bigger in general. It doesn't even just look bigger, it is bigger. So understand it's gonna be bigger, it's gonna weigh more. Pros and cons to everything on how you have stuff set up for your use case. Some of the LPVO technology is getting so commonplace now that you can get cheaper 1-6s from some weird brands, and it's not going to be quite as bad. I like the Vortex Viper 1-6. That's about the cheapest LPVO that I recommend to people. You can find those on sale pretty regularly from places like EuroOptic for $500, maybe $450 if you get an additional discount code or something goofy like that through like Palmetto State Armory or something like that. But expect to pay around $500 for a good 1-6 or 1-8. And that's just the reality, guys. Like, if that sounds like too much money for you, then maybe you don't need to be building a gun that's going to reach out that far, which gets us to, like red dots, right? 1X magnification optics, red dots, and I would say holographic, but the only real holographic optics that are out there, you're talking EOTEX, dot electronic optics, they have their EHS-1, I think, which I've seen mixed reviews on some of that. The Huey from Vortex is holographic, and I think Sentinel Defense is this new company that's on the scene now, around, you know, or just after SHOT Show this year. I'm seeing them sending out a bunch of units to influencers and stuff, and by all accounts, I got to check one out, and it does not seem bad, but that's still going to be about a $450 optic, just FYI. The advantage to holographic optics is they're going to be good for you if you have astigmatism. Like, my wife has broke eyes, so she really likes the EXPS2 she's running from EOTech and has been running. But they're also widely regarded in most cases to be parallax free, so it's going to help with accuracy if you don't have the most refined shooting position. Whereas standard red dots, maybe not so much. Now, what I will say is that comparatively, red dots kick the shit out of holographic sights in battery life. They're also usually much smaller. Holographics, just because of the technology behind them, they're big, chunky optics, and they have more internals. It's just the way it is, guys. So when we're looking into stuff like that, if you want a lighter, smaller, compact setup, something that looks like an Aimpoint T2, like a micro red dot, something that's a compact design style body, is going to probably be where you want to end up. Now, the Aimpoint T2 is prohibitively expensive. Like, Aimpoint has a long history of supporting militaries around the world because they have really, really reliable and bomb-proof optics, right? So maybe something from Vortex or Hollow Sun or one of these companies that makes a very similar style to that, where it's a micro red dot SIG. I think it's the 4MT or something like that. I don't know. One of the Romeo red dots, or they have several out there. Those are going to be okay. I had Bushnell TRS-25. Was my very first red dot on my very first rifle. So, but red dots in general, they have a really long battery life. Most of them now today, as long as you're paying, I would say at least $200 for one, you're getting a fairly reliable optic, and they all share the T2 footprint, meaning that if you want a different mount, you know, because you want a taller mount or something, you can get those pretty affordably. Now, if we are talking about, you know, optic height mounts, I usually just recommend people get a lower 1/3. If they don't shoot a lot. It's a very, very common height. It's going to co-witness just over iron sights if you're somebody that's running a fixed iron sight gun, which can make teaching people a little bit easier, that whole lollipop thing, put the red dot on top of the, you know, front iron sight post or whatever. It can have some advantages. It's also going to be easier with holds at distances for those people to be successful. Now, if you're somebody who's been shooting a little bit longer, yes, you can get into like 193 mounts. You can get into 226 height mounts or 233 height. Or if you're running, yeah, you want to be like GBRS Group and you want to run the Hydra, I think that's like 291. Just understand, you guys, as you get taller with your optic mounts, your holds change, and you have to be responsible and be aware of that ballistic information and how to apply that at different ranges and different distances. For example, I used to run a 1-6 LPVO on a 193 mount from American Defense Manufacturing. It was their recon mount. And I really liked it for heads-up shooting because 193 was a little bit more forgiving on the neck than 1.5 is, or 1.55 or 1.57, whatever your lower 1/3 is. But at distance, I found that I had more issues with it. So bringing it down to that 1.57 height, that lower 1/3 height that most scopes are mounted at, allowed me to be better at distance. So just, it's kind of the right tool for the right job conversation, you know what I mean? So when we're having those discussions, being aware of that stuff is critically important, okay? So something to keep in the back of your mind. Now, if you're wanting a taller optic mount because you run night vision and you don't want an obstructed window because of the laser unit, yes, 193, 226 height, those do tend to work a little bit better. If you do want a little bit more height because just your neck and you don't like laying your face across the rifle, that's how I feel about it, you know? Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Understand those mounts are going to cost you more money. I know the mounts from Unity can be quite expensive. I'm running one from Arisaka, which was about $100 and runs off the Acro footprint, which is a little bit different. They can do it with the T2 as well. And you guys can look into all of these different things. Some of these optics share footprints. Some of them really don't. One of the things I would steer clear of personally, though, is we are seeing a couple out there. They're open emitter dots for rifles. I know Hollow Sun makes one, and I have seen some people running like RMRs or Delta Point Pros and stuff on rifles. I know Unity makes them out that lets you do that, and there's a couple other ones out there too. Those are not going to be the most durable optics, and for a fighting rifle, I think an enclosed dot is going to do the best for you, and ultimately going to be the best choice. But you guys make your own decisions. There's a lot of research out there. You can go look on YouTube. You can find whatever dot optic, whatever works for you. If you want to run a magnifier with your red dot so you can get, you know, a 3x or a 5x magnification to reach out to distance, you can do that as well. Understand that the eye relief on a magnifier is in a lot of cases going to be worse than what a scope would be. So like how close your eye actually gets to the body of the scope, that's your eye relief, where that black like shadow around your target picture starts to go away. When you have good eye relief, you don't get that. When you have bad eye relief, you know, half of what you're seeing is that black like shadowy ring around it. So you're going to get that with LPVOs and MPVOs. You're going to get that with magnifiers. Some are better than others. Vortex has a pretty forgiving eye relief or eye box to it. I just know that one because that's what I've shot is a lot of Vortex stuff. Some other brands have very generous ones too. Bad ones don't have very, you know, forgiving relief. So something to be aware of. You're not just gonna be able to snap the gun up every time and get that instant picture and have it be completely perfect if you want to run a scope of some variety. But just when you make the decision, understand what the pros, cons, the strengths and weaknesses of your optical sighting system are, combined with the height of the optic and the holdovers, paired with the ballistic performance of the ammo that you selected and the barrel length. So it all kind of ties together, right? So we started with ammo, we got to barrel length, then we talked about optics and optic heights. Those four things kind of build like a four-legged stool. And if one of those things ain't right, you're going to start having just a little bit of wobble. It still work. You can still sit on it, right? But it's going to just not be quite as stable and reliable as you might like. So be really, really cognizant and really, really aware of those. Now, while we're talking about this, I will mention also as backup sighting systems for a fighting rifle. I do think you should have at least two sighting systems of some variety on your rifle. For most people that are real spun up and are doing all kinds of shit, you got night vision, right? Your laser aiming module, your LAM, which is called a laser, right, is going to be your backup or secondary sighting. So you can use a visible laser or IR laser under night vision. And what I do recommend to folks is if you are buying a laser, get one with all three parts. Get a Vis laser, an IR laser, and an IR illuminator. There are some really affordable models on the market right now that actually are not bad. They're sub $1,000, specifically looking at like the MT6, I think, from Laser Speed, which, yes, is Chinese. The Holosun Iris, which, yes, is Chinese. And then also the SMS Trinity, which is like sub $400 and very Chinese. But they have proven so far that those are good, reliable choices with decent controls behind them. If you want something American, just understand it's going to cost you probably three times the money, if not way more than that. But, you know, if you're getting into the night vision game, it's a pay-to-play experience. If you have already bought your tubes, you probably know that. If you are at this point in the conversation starting to reconsider it or have thoughts and questions, reach out to the guys at Custom Night Vision. They're a sponsor here at the podcast, obviously, but they're very responsive and receptive to questions. So if you have questions about getting into night vision, how it's going to work with your rifle, and then lasers, right? They don't stock every laser on the market, but they do stock most of them. So if you want the Holosun Iris, they actually do carry that one. They have the D-Ball for probably, the D-Ball is it's dual beam aiming laser. Steiner makes it. It's been used by military and law enforcement across the world. Is it the best illuminator? Which an illuminator is just a flashlight that only works on the IR spectrum in the simplest of terms. Got somebody asking about that in the last couple of days. It's not the greatest illuminator. The laser is going to be the exact same civilian-powered laser you're going to get on most units. So the Food and Drug Administration actually does control lasers, and that's why we have issues with the civilian power units. The lasers are usually fine. The illuminators used to just be a diffused laser. So because it was that neutered power output, you know, managed by the FDA, you basically then weakened it and turned it into a flashlight by putting it through a diffuser. Now we have V-cell technology, which is a vertical cavity space emitting laser, is what V-cell stands for. And I don't know the science behind it. I just know what the acronym is, but those are not lasers and they allow for a much stronger illuminator. It's what the Iris uses. It's what the Trinity uses. It's what the Mall, the Wilcox Raid, what they use. And just understand once you get into those units, the controls are very different unit to unit. And understand if you have an offset aiming laser or an overbore aiming laser, and then you'll have to zero that independently. It's the nice part about having the Vis laser is that they're co-aligned on the same optical bench within the unit. If you zero your Vis laser correctly, you are zeroing your IR laser correctly. And again, as long as you understand the holds with that, you're going to be okay. So, and I don't want to get too far into that because you can go down a wormhole in lasers and night vision and all that stuff. Additionally, the last piece here on the upper is a muzzle device or suppressor. Understand if you buy a suppressor, in most cases, you have to have a matching muzzle device that goes with it, because you can't just put any suppressor on any muzzle device. If you want a Surefire RC2, you got to have their either war comp, flash hider, or muzzle brake, one of the three. My personal preference is the flash hider. Now, I have a war comp on one gun because it came with it pinned and welded. I like the flash hider personally because you can still be pretty effective with that. I don't like muzzle brakes. Yes, it's going to be a much flatter shooting experience, but it's going to be annoying for all of your buddies around you, and it's going to be really loud, and there's going to be a huge fireball. So my thought with the minimal recoil on a 5.56 gun is signature reduction, which actually most A2 bird cages and three-prong flash hiders from both, you know, Surefire and Dead Air perform pretty fucking well. And then after that, just get whatever suppressor you want. You know, there's flow through technology now that's going to make it less gassy. It's going to help with the recoil a little bit, but be careful. I did have a buddy also like set up a 300 blackout with a flow through 30 cal can, and actually had to go to a buffer spring and buffer weight tuned for blanks, because there's so much gas was being vented off of it, the system didn't have enough to reciprocate correctly. So tuning is going to be a real thing when you get into suppressing your 5.56, your 308, your 300 blackout rifle. Now, when we get into the lower receiver here, I don't want to make this like a footnote, but it's kind of a footnote. For me, I run mil-spec lowers. I'm right-handed, so everything's built for me. You know, I run a mil-spec safety. I don't run an ambi safety, and I don't necessarily always recommend it, because I can think of zero times in my shooting where I've been like, man, you know what would be really freaking nice right now? An ambidextrous safety. I've never found that I needed it. Yes, you can get a different safety lever that's still a regular safety. It just has a more aggressive texture. You can totally do that. That's your prerogative. What I will caution people to is just be aware that some of those, if it's just a set screw that holds that in, I've watched those and actually when we had the Orion Training Group class here in May of last year, two separate occasions on two different days, right? We had guys, like literally the safeties just fell off their guns. One of them was a Unit Solutions rifle, another one was an actual rifle, and the safety just fell off because it's just a set screw. So that's why I like running mil-spec safeties, you know, and if it starts wearing out, you just replace the spring. Take off the grip, replace the spring, put the grip back on, easy to go. But that's a personal preference thing. If you're a lefty, yes, unfortunately, you're probably going to have to either learn some fucked up back-assward way of running your gun, or get an ambi lower, like something from American Defense Manufacturing that has a ambi bolt release and mag release. And then obviously ambidextrous safety controls. But I run mil-spec on my safeties. I also run mil-spec triggers. I know you can do a lot of stuff with triggers. I don't think I'm a good enough shooter personally. And if you're looking for, I don't think I'm a good enough shooter to need a really light trigger at this point. Although if you're doing it for a precision build, like an SPR or a DMR, the Geissele SSAE-X, also known as the Lightning Bow, I do have one of those in my SPR, and it is so nice. But if you're just trying to run the gun fast, yeah, something like that could be really cool. Understand that a mil-spec trigger costs about $15-$20, and a lightning bow costs about $320. So if you want, those are your options. Now you can get stuff in between. The ALG, which is a child company of Geissele, but the ALG Advanced Combat Trigger is what I run in my 11.5 and has been very good. It's just a little bit crisper, a little bit cleaner break than a quote-unquote normal mil-spec. I've also heard really good things about the LaRue trigger. So both of those are right around $80 to $100, and are good options. I know there's a ton of companies that make drop-in triggers, single stage, dual stage, whatever. My advice, if you're not sure which one's for you, just get a mil-spec and learn how to run the shit out of that. With your lower, past that, get a good mil-spec lower receiver from a reputable brand. The off-brand stuff, don't get skeletonized or lightened or with the weird Molin Labe, like, you know, Spartan helmet cut in the magwell. That's just more shit to get your magazines hung up on. I do swap out my trigger guards to be a little bit bigger to fit a glove in there. I don't like the flat or straight trigger guard that's mil-spec, just because it cuts into my finger during reloads when I'm holding the gun up with one hand. But yeah, get mil-spec. You know, if you want to add a magwell on there for easier reloads, if you think it's going to help you, cool. God bless. And then pick some furniture that's going to help you. So get, you know, BCM furniture, either a stock or a pistol grip. Magpul makes some really good stuff. Currently, I'm actually running the new grip from 100 Concepts. So that's been a T&E item on my gun that's going to stay there. And then on the stock, I run the B5 Systems Bravo. I don't have the storage tubes in there. I don't need it, but it's got a little bit more real estate for cheek weld and cheek appreciation. And right now I have a riser on it because I run a 226 optic. So you can put a cheek riser on there. It just gives you, again, just more surface area on your cheek to accommodate that strong shooting platform and connection to the gun. But really that stuff, the furniture, the, you know, foregrips out on the front of the gun, any of that kind of stuff really, and I haven't really gotten into that, or lights, you know, a white light and a sling, absolutely necessary. Maybe it's weird that I put this at the very end, but just get a good 2-point sling with good attachments, whether that's 550 cord, cause that's what you like and it's quiet, or QDs from a reputable brand. Like the two, the only ones I recommend are BCM or Magpul. Cheap QD sockets and cheap QD mounts will fail you. I've had it happen to me. They get dirty, they fail. Even the good ones get dirty, and then you got to like clean the shit out of them to get them to work again. But just make sure you take care of it and get a good 2-point adjustable sling. I use Huberworks out of Pennsylvania for mine. They're like $35. Really, really great slings. Caleb is a homie. He's a great dude. Makes really, really great products. And then as far as white lights go, just have one on your gun. Obviously, a nicer one's going to be better, but having one in general is better than nothing. I don't recommend using pistol lights on rifles just because they're designed for different uses and applications. The controls are designed to be used very differently. I built a light. I used an Arisaka body with a Surefire tail cap and a Mod Light OKW head on my 11.5, and that's because the candela on the Mod Light is just going to punch through photonic barriers. It's going to perform better. Streamlight makes a pretty good budget one that comes with the controls. Understand, if you buy Surefire, if you build a light with parts like what I just did, you're going to spend a lot more money. And then the pressure pads are an additional $70 to $150, depending on what you want. And then you got to set it up, you know, however you want it. I got away from using pressure pads as much as I could. So I use the fire button on my lasers and then a single angled unity button for my flashlight on my 11.5. That's kind of how I like setting them up now. And I'm going to probably try to move to that in the future. But that's my preference. That's stuff you guys have to figure that out. Just get a white light. If you want to buy one that comes with everything, your mount, your pressure pad, everything all in one, just go buy the Streamlight HLX. Just go buy that, and you, in more cases than that, you'll be good to go. So, I don't know. I already went over. I'm at like an hour 7. Oh, Jesus, just like rambling about this stuff. But hopefully, this is helpful for you guys. Again, this is what some of you guys asked for in the comment section. So I tried to address this as well and as completely as I could. If I missed anything, please feel free to send me a message, drop it in the comments. I'll try to, you know, address those things. But again, hopefully this was helpful for you and at least entertaining. I don't know. But that's all I got for this week's discussion, you guys. Thank you so much for checking this out. Make sure you're checking out our YouTube channel and our Instagram and the Patreon page. As always, support goes so far to help with the mission here at Prepared Mindset, which is to continue to bring this information to you guys to help everybody be more prepared, more capable citizens. So thank you so much for listening to this week's episode, listening to me. We'll be back next week. Same bad time, same bad channel, all that good stuff, right? Stay safe out there. And like we always say here, work hard, train smarter, and be prepared.